This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. And it's been a week of startling twists of legal fate. Tuesday, Jared Remy took the rare step of pleading guilty to stabbing to death his girlfriend, Jennifer Martell. That means he'll spend life in prison with no chance for parole. On Wednesday, a court threw out the murder conviction of a former FBI agent charged in a mob killing ordered by Whitey Bulger. And today, a Quincy taxi driver was charged with obstructing the FBI investigation into the Marathon bombings. The cabbie was arraigned just minutes ago at the Moakley Federal Courthouse, where WBUR's David Boeri is now. And David joins us by phone. Hi, David.
Hi, Sasha.
And David, what do we know about this man arraigned today? His name, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, is Hyrulajan Matanov.
That's right. Hyrulajan, 23 years old, a cab driver, lives in Quincy, showed up in a Levi t-shirt, a Levi white t-shirt, black hair. He's thin, good looking, has no wife, no children, no family here in the country. He speaks English fluently. And according to this indictment, he's a fascinating figure.
And so what is he alleged to have done to block the FBI investigation into the Marathon bombings?
Well, let's talk first. What actually, Sasha, is more important than the charges in a way, because we have Zohar Zanaya facing a murder case this fall in which the death penalty is involved. Let's talk about the association, because that is what jumps out at you. According to this indictment, Hyrulajan Matanov actually called one of the brothers within 40 minutes of that bombing last April 2013 and then had dinner with both brothers at a local restaurant that very evening. That day set a pattern, the government alleges, of Matanov trying to contact them and actually contacting them over the next 4 days. And that is what's so fascinating. If I can, Sasha, it's interesting to look at the timeline, because on the first day, he meets with them, talks to them. Then there's Wednesday. He talks to Tamerlan Zanayev, the older brother, twice, meets with him later that day. That's Wednesday. Then on Thursday, according to the indictment, around between 5 and 7 in the evening, Matanov is actually accessing the news websites that show the suspects' photos. So presumably he knows these are his friends. A few hours later, he makes a phone call to Zohar. And then finally, on Friday morning, after the shootout and when law enforcement is seeking the younger brother, Matanov is on the computer between 2 and 2:30 in the morning. He sees the photos again and then tries to call Zohar at 7 in the morning. So what is he talking about? Why is he trying to call them? What are they talking about over dinner? That is what's fascinating.
And is it clear from the indictment whether the night of the dinner, the day of the bombings, he knew they were the suspects?
It's an interesting point, and it looks as if by the government's own indictment here, they are not telling him over that dinner. But the reason why he is important, and by the way, the charges here are that he made false statements to investigators and tried to destroy the evidence, which was the stuff on the computer. But the key would seem to be that we have a trial coming up, a death penalty trial, in which the government wants and seeks all that they can get. So, and this is speculation, but for instance, if they talk at that dinner about jihad, and you have the younger brother talking about his happiness with jihad and how he embraces it, or if some of that stuff that was dumped off the computer connect the younger brother, who isn't yet a hard, he hasn't been exactly defined by the prosecutors as believing in jihad like his older brother has been. If there's something there, then it would enable that case at the trial to seek the death penalty. That, I think, raises the stakes of this tremendously.
And if this man, this taxi driver, is convicted on the charges, what kind of sentence is he looking at?
Well, this too, in the typical course of federal court, they have charges here that they add up to the maximums. It would be 20 years max for destroying that evidence in the computer, 8 years apiece for false statements, so we're up to 43 years, and they're coming at him now before the trial. It's a convenient time to come to him, and it's a maximum force sentence that may well encourage him to cooperate.
Right, that's quite a bit of time for a man in his early 20s. That's WBUR reporter David Boeri. David, thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome.
And let's pick up these latest developments in the Marathon bombing investigation with our Week in Review panel. This week, we have Dante Ramos, deputy editorial page editor at the Boston Globe. Hi, Dante.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. And also David Scharfenberg, WBUR political reporter. Hi, David. He's here with me in the studio.
Hi there.
And David and Dante, question for both of you. Now, when this arrest sort of came across the airwaves this morning, my sense of surprise was because it had sort of seemed that the dragnet in terms of who might be arrested, I think many people assumed we found all the people. There were certainly many legal things to still resolve in the case. But I'm wondering if the two of you shared that sense of surprise that here, a year later, we have another person being arrested.
Shall I start?
Sure, go ahead, Dante.
I think your reporter's speculation, and he certainly couched it that way, it seemed similar to my own assessment of things. I mean, the thing to remember is that the Tsarnaev brothers were, they were in some ways alienated, especially the older one, from aspects of life in the United States, but they were also deeply enmeshed in other ways, and they had friends, and they had people that you could search their cell phone records and find that there was a discussion that was going on. So there were certainly people all around them who might possibly have known something, and the premium here on finding someone who knows something, and specifically somebody who can speak to a sort of jihadist kind of motivation, is pretty high for the FBI. And, you know, if you read the indictment, it doesn't suggest anything close to the fact that Matanov knew anything in advance, or even, as your reporter said at that dinner, that he knew what was going on. But it feels like the type of thing that they would put out, or the kind of pressure that they would put on if they're trying to get somebody to testify who's reluctant to testify.
Sure, aggressive reach of the FBI, if maybe not surprising reach of the FBI. You know, one other interesting thing about this indictment is that it reminds us that the Marathon bombings were not universally condemned. You know, for example, it alleges that on the night of the bombings, this man, Matanov, told an unnamed person, a person who's not identified in the indictment, that, quote, that the attack could have had a just reason, such as being done in the name of Islam, and that he would support the bombings if the reason were just, or if the attack had been done by the Taliban. David Scharfenberg, I was interested in your reaction to that.
Well, certainly, yes, these folks did have a tight network of friends, as Dante was suggesting, and there are some who may have shared their views. I think it's safe to say this is still quite a minority view here in Boston. And in regard to the timing of this, I did speak with Brian Kelly, former U.S. assistant attorney, former assistant U.S. attorney, I should say. He prosecuted Whitey Bulger. He told me today that he didn't think it was all that unusual that this indictment would come out a year later. He says it takes time to put these cases together. You've got to assemble witnesses, documents, the grand jury. You know, the Tsarnaevs themselves, if they're arrested, you got to issue an indictment within a prescribed period of time if they're in your custody. Otherwise, investigators are going to take the time they need to put these cases together. I don't know if we'll see any others, but not so surprising that this one took some time.
Another big development this week is that John Connolly, the corrupt FBI agent who helped Whitey Bulger elude arrest, may be released from prison soon. And that's because a federal appeals court has overturned his second-degree murder conviction. And this feels like an outrage to family members of victims. Here's Tommy Donahue, whose father was killed by Bulger.
John Connolly is one of the main reasons why my father is dead. He leaked the information. He covered up the information. You know, he shouldn't be the only one in prison. There should be a lot of them behind him.
Now, Dante and David, as you know, Connolly's conviction was overturned due to what some people are calling a technicality. Basically, an appeals court ruled that prosecutors overreached when they charged Connolly with second-degree murder in the case of a Florida man. The Florida man was actually killed by one of Whitey Bulger's hitmen. But because Connolly was carrying a gun when he talked with Bulger about that Florida man, and this was a gun he had simply because he was an FBI agent, prosecutors got him on a firearms charge. So David Boeri, who we just spoke with, still has tape of himself asking prosecutor Michael Von Zampft about that back in 2008.
When he's meeting with these people and he's giving them information, he is possessing and carrying that firearm.
He meets the standard by virtue of having a gun in Massachusetts?
Yeah, that's correct.
Even though having a gun was a condition of his employment with the FBI?
We didn't choose Mr. Connolly's occupation. He did. We didn't choose for Mr. Connolly to turn around and become a corrupt agent. He did.
Now, Dante, that Connolly's conviction would be overturned this way has been described as a Kafkaesque twist, but even maybe more Kafkaesque is that he was convicted this way in the first place.
Well, right. My colleague Kevin Cullen, who's written more about this than almost anybody I know, pointed out that the verdict, the second-degree murder conviction, was in a way a kind of rough or compromised sort of justice, in the sense that, you know, he was there in that courtroom and people seemed to think that Connolly had obviously done something wrong, and yet the witness who had testified him was a murderer and or testified against him was a murderer who had gotten immunity, and the idea that he would get a lesser sentence because of it. I mean, there's a lot of kind of contrary currents that are sort of sweeping about this case, and so you get the situation where somebody who perhaps out of jury sentiment was convicted, but on grounds that were a little bit shaky. I mean, those are things that maybe felt to jurors like they served a sense of justice, but, you know, do have a little bit of a tendency to unravel over time in the appeals process. It's worth noting that I believe it was not a unanimous decision by the appeals court in Florida, but there certainly was a risk that this would happen that was perceived quite a long time ago.
Any sense whether there are larger lessons here for prosecutors who are trying to make charges stick, maybe by going too far out on a legal limb?
Well, you know, it's a question that comes up all the time in big ways and small ways in criminal cases, which is that, you know, anytime we have this discussion of cutting corners legally or using evidence that's a little bit shaky or, you know, even as we were talking about in the previous segment, you know, getting testimony from people who are reluctant witnesses or whatever, there are things that can feel like they help the moral burden of a case to be decided against a defendant. On the other hand, you know, if some of those elements are a little bit questionable or debatable, that it certainly raises the possibility that a verdict that might serve the cause of justice gets undone over time.
And David Scharfenberg, you know, as you know, Johnny Depp is in town filming a Whitey Bulger movie. Any sense of whether John Connolly may be out of jail soon enough to see the premiere of that Whitey Bulger movie?
Well, it's possible, and I think that would be shocking to all involved, not least of them John Connolly himself, who
right.
apparently, if reports are to be believed, is pretty shocked by this turn of events. That said, U.S. Attorney Brian Kelly, who I spoke with earlier today, spoke with WBUR earlier this week and suggested that Massachusetts authorities could potentially pursue additional murder charges against Connolly in the cases of Brian Halloran and Michael Donahue. Bulger associates during Whitey Bulger's trial testified that Bulger killed Halloran because Connolly, the FBI agent, had tipped him off that Halloran might be cooperating with the FBI, might implicate him in other murders. Donahue, of course, was an innocent bystander giving Halloran a ride home when he was killed. So he could face more charges. He may not be out as soon as his family and advocates would hope.
Another surprising development in court this week is the case of Jared Remy, who admitted that he stabbed his girlfriend Jennifer Martel to death after an argument. And he was pretty chilling when he explained in court this week why he murdered her.
I always told Jen she could leave, but do not threaten me with my daughter. That night, Jen had a knife in her hand and threatened me with my daughter. So I killed her.
And then after the sentencing, Jennifer Martel's family released a statement.
We do not have the words to express our emotions regarding the tragic and senseless murder of our daughter, Jennifer. We hope that Jared has remorse for what he did to her and to our granddaughter. If just one family learns from our tragedy by recognizing the warning signs of domestic violence, it will help us to honor Jennifer's memory.
David, it's been established that Jared Remy was a serial domestic abuser, and the DA's office admits it made mistakes in this case. The Globe, for example, reported that he terrorized 5 different girlfriends since his teenage years. Do you have any sense of whether this one case, this high-profile case, is enough to really meaningfully reform the way courts handle abuse cases?
Well, this is how things unfold oftentimes. We have a case like this spilled over the front of the papers, heard on the radio, and that can drive change. We have seen some. Robert DeLeo, the House Speaker, introduced legislation that would toughen penalties for repeat abusers. It would require bail commissioners to justify their decisions in writing before they released an accused batterer. That's what happened here. Jared Remy was in custody for allegedly smashing his girlfriend's head into a mirror before he was released and then committed this murder. As you mentioned, the Middlesex DA has acknowledged that her office erred in failing to request bail in that case or to ask that he be held. So we may see some change here. We've already seen some. We'll see how quickly or slowly this fades from the public memory.
And Dante, typically when pleas are made, it's in exchange for some kind of reduced sentence. But this is a first-degree murder plea. That means voluntarily, Jared Remy knew he was going to life in prison without parole. Do you have a sense of why he made that decision, or his lawyers persuaded him to make that decision, any way to avoid a civil suit, simply spare everyone, including his family, a trial?
It would be purely speculating on my part. It's clear that there didn't seem to be much chance that he would avoid being convicted. The evidence against him was pretty strong. There were eyewitnesses. The conditions of the murder were absolutely hideous. And so it doesn't sound as though there was a whole lot of hope of him avoiding this fate one way or another. His parents weren't present, I believe, at the hearing, which had been billed as a kind of a more routine, initially as a more routine sort of proceeding. But that ostensibly was at Jared Remy's request. So maybe that was something that he did out of deference to his family. At the same time, you can tell from his statement that he's clearly someone who is certainly more caught up in his own way of doing things than shows a lot of deference to a whole lot of other people.
Sure. Another case this week is the ongoing corruption trial of the former Massachusetts Probation Commissioner John O'Brien. And David, you have spent time in that courtroom watching that testimony. This is a case where jurors are going to have to decide what is legal patronage, because patronage is not illegal, and then what is illegal criminal fraud when it comes to government hiring. And the testimony has been quite, I mean, it's been quite fascinating to watch, because it's clear that many people got their jobs simply because of who they know or who they were related to. I'm wondering, though, David, if despite this evidence, the defense is, as we know, is going to make an argument that this happened everywhere. This is just how government works. And I'm wondering if you have any sense from what you watched of whether the prosecutors may not get what they want in the end, because the jury will say, well, this is the system and it is a legal system. And it is not illegal to do this. And it's not just limited to the probation department.
That's certainly possible. The judge himself has made it clear that patronage itself is not illegal. He said under President Andrew Jackson, this is virtually the law of the land. So he's made that clear. He's made that clear to the jury. And with the jury out of the room, he's expressed some hesitance about the prosecution's case here, some skepticism. We'll see, of course, what the jury thinks. That's all that matters. But patronage itself, not illegal. The defense has to prove that he and his two deputies covered up this vast system of political patronage in a fraudulent way. And so, you know, that's a bit tougher to prove. But I think the prosecution has done a reasonably good job of suggesting that there were quite a few unqualified hires. Once and if they've established that, then they might have an easier time suggesting that their efforts to cover that up, to suggest that they were hiring the most qualified people, amounted to fraud. But, you know, I think anyone who sees this system of patronage, who read the Globe Spotlight series on this several years ago, would think it was clearly flawed. But as we saw in the case of John Connolly, the FBI agent, sometimes there's a real disconnect between kind of the public sense of justice and what happens in a courtroom. And, you know, that's reassuring in a way. I mean, we should have a higher standard there. It's people's freedom and lives at risk here. But it can be frustrating, I'm sure, for folks at times, too.
Dante, do you think it's having that public effect, kind of exposing the unsavory underbelly of how civil service hiring often happens?
I think it does expose a real unsavory underbelly. You know, you want to think that standards have improved since the Andrew Jackson administration. It doesn't appear from this case that it really does. And it's unfortunate. I mean, I think that if the prosecutors can show a real pattern of manipulating what looks on the surface to be like a legitimate process, and, you know, they do stand a chance of getting a conviction. But the deeper problem here is precisely that this is accepted in as regular behavior in Massachusetts. And the law is built in a way that, you know, if O'Brien had pocketed $200 in baseball tickets from somebody or some kind of personal bribe, then that's something that the judicial system can handle easily. If it's a broader pattern of people doing things for really terrible reasons but are political reasons and involve hoarding power rather than money, it's something that the system doesn't really know how to adjust to or handle.
So,
and it's a little unfortunate.
Any chance of reform coming as a result of this?
If you look at the number of legislators who've been mentioned in this, there are, you know, it's certainly the type of situation where moving the probation office from one department to another, it's been entertained, or having some kind of superficial reform of the process. But what you really need is a deeper refusal to accept this as part of the political culture. Just as a personal observation, you know, just as a journalist who covers politics in Massachusetts, it's striking to me how many people will say, oh yeah, I recommend people for jobs, or have admitted to doing so, compared with other places that I've lived. I've lived in Louisiana, in Rhode Island. This is surprising to me.
That's really interesting. All right, time now for our hubbubs, which both of you have done before. These are the stories that kind of fell below the fold or the front page, but they did catch our attention. David, why don't you start us off? What's your hubbub today?
Well, Amazon.com just released its fourth annual Most Well-Read Cities in America list, Cambridge, Massachusetts ranked in the top 10, came in at number 8. I was actually a little disappointed by that.
That it wasn't higher?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Orlando is over Cambridge. I'm not
really
sure what's going on there.
I wonder how the methodology worked on
Seriously. But Amazon did find that Cambridge was most likely to buy print books as opposed to the digital version. So I
Old
think
school.
The city can hold on to its kind of mustier-than-thou reputation heading forward.
And Dante, your hubbub?
Well, speaking of Cambridge, in his commencement address at Harvard this week, Michael Bloomberg, the former New York City mayor, gave a shout out to one of the city's enduring cultural institutions, that being the Hong Kong, the time-honored Chinese restaurant, which is best known for a cocktail involving a bowl of liquid and long straws. Many long straws, as many as you have IDs at the table. And as Bloomberg told graduates, have one last scorpion bowl at the Kong. On second thought, don't. I actually think the Kong has a bad rap. They helped resolve that whole dust-up at Harvard about the Black Mass. The Satanists who were proposing the Black Mass ended up just having drinks at the Hong Kong instead. So I think it's good that their role as a larger community institution be recognized, and that their secret family recipe of alcohol and juices be commemorated in this important way.
For my hubbub, I want to go back to Tuesday night, when I was at home on my couch at about 10:30 in the evening, and suddenly this a loud air horn type sound went off, and I could not figure out where it was coming from. It felt like it was in the house, but I didn't know where it was. I then began to see on Twitter that there's this flood alert that went out and was activating some people's iPhones. But then yesterday morning in the Globe, I see this story about many people apparently having that sense of surprise and shock and learning for the first time that their phones can do this. It's apparently part of this national public safety system that lets authorized government agencies send alerts to your mobile device. Were the two of you around when this happened?
Sure, yeah.
I was too. It was surprising.
Yeah.
So, good. I wasn't the only one. So it was really interesting. It was a flash flood alert that ultimately didn't really happen. But the lesson also to remember is you can disable these. Not that it's recommended, but you can go into Google settings or whatever your smartphone settings is and disable it. So that's what that was all about. So that is it for our week in review. But before we go, I do want to note that David Scharfenberg, this is your last day at WBUR. This is a huge loss to WBUR, but also a big gain to the Boston Globe. Because
indeed,
David is going to join the Boston Globe's political team based out of the State House Bureau with some very legendary reporters over there like Frank Phillips and right. So forth. So I want to say congratulations. It's been wonderful having you here. We've loved having you on the week in review. And again, Dante, you're getting a great reporter from WBUR to go and help the Globe continue to do great political coverage.
I know. Come on over.
Thank you. Thank you, Sasha. And thank you, Dante.
So thanks to both of you. Dante Ramos, again, deputy editorial page editor of the Boston Globe, and David Scharfenberg, WBUR political reporter, soon to be Boston Globe political reporter. Thanks to all of you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, a profile of Boston Beer Company, which celebrates its 30th anniversary this year. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.